ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
How would you feel if you learned you may be descended from Vikings? It might change the way you see yourself and your family. We'll find out soon how celebrity chef Manu Fadel felt about it on Life Matters. But first up, should doctors be prescribing social connection for some of what ails us? The complex intersection between our health and our relationships up next. I'm Hilary Harper, coming to you from Naarm, Melbourne. If you went to the doctor with a health problem and they prescribed joining a club or a cooking class rather than giving you medication or a referral onwards, how would you feel about that? It's called social prescribing, and it's where healthcare providers connect people with programs in their local community to improve their mental and physical health. How effective is it is one question that raises. We're going to look at this today from the GP perspective, the people who make the referrals, and also someone who receives those referrals and helps connect people in this way. But if this is something that you've been involved in, I'd love to hear how it's gone for you. Dr. Richard Mays is a GP at Goldfields Medical Group in Castlemaine. Welcome, Richard.
Thank you very much, Hilary. Thanks for having me.
Great pleasure to talk to you today. I know you've been very involved with this and have seen the benefits yourself. We also have with us today Nerida Dye, who's the Community Outreach Coordinator for Campaspe Library in Echuca. Nerida, great to have you on the program.
Thanks for having me.
Great to speak with you. Richard, I'll start with you. Why did you become so interested in social prescribing?
Well, right at the moment, I was invited by our Get Connected program. So our Mount Alexander Shire group invited me in as a GP, mainly because they knew that I was actively involved in social prescribing in our community as the dancing doctor and supporter of our Silver Tops dance therapy class.
Tell us a little bit more about this dancing doctor label and how that came about.
Well, let me sum up. I have always loved being involved in local community activities and health, and part of that was my sister set up our local Run the Main fun run. So a fun run that was set up to raise monies and funds for our local hospital, Delkire Health, or what was previously known as Castlemaine Health. Being the younger brother, I was not given an important job. I was given the job of getting dressed up as a bird and running around entertaining everyone between the run and the results. And one year, music came on and I just did a daggy dance just to fill the gap. And it became a bit of a thing. The next year, there was a bit of a crowd around waiting for the bird dance. And the bird dance became a tradition, and but also my teenagers became more and more distressed at my lame dance moves. So I called upon a good friend of mine, and Sarah Cook from Movement Zone, and she set up an adult dance class, which rolled into us putting together the Soul Funkers adult dance class at Movement Zone. At the same time, the Mary Hoyne, a great singer and entertainer and community-based singer in Castlemaine, was setting up a flash mob for the Fringe Festival and asked us Soul Funkers to be their backup dancers. And that resulted in a Irene Cara's Oh What a Feeling rendition of Dancers and Singers in our local supermarket, which resulted in me doing a backspin in aisle 7 and the community seeing their GP having an absolute ball dancing and going crazy, wondering what is he on. And patients started coming to the clinic, coming to Sarah Cook, the Movement Zone dance instructor, and saying, we want a bit of this medicine. And so we set up the Silver Tops dance therapy class. So the Silver Tops indicates we've got a high average age, probably in the high 70s, but they have been going gangbusters for the last 3 years. They go into community doing their own little flash mobs. They've been invited to conferences and concerts. And right now we're setting up to head into a local aged care facility tomorrow to dance. And the stories that have come out of that's the connection socially, the activity socially, and getting them together has been huge benefits individually and also across our community.
That's the key thing, isn't it? I guess I'm keen to know how strong this link is and what the evidence says about the benefits to people of social connection. Because, I mean, I imagine as a GP, if you're going to be prescribing going and having more social connection. You'd want to be fairly clear about the results that you might expect.
Yeah, that's the thing. And what we see anecdotally, and we ran a pilot program called Get Connected. So when I say we, that was the headed by Carolyn Jennings and the Mount Alexander Shire Council, set up a pilot in the last couple of years called Get Connected. And it was a program to test and see what social prescribing, how it could be run in a community. And when I often think about social prescribing, and a lot of my colleagues are probably listening going, Richard, this is the backbone of what we do. It's been what we do for years. What we're talking about is a formal process where we're part of our toolkit of management is we pull out a referral to our local connector. So Narrador will probably talk to that role as a link worker or connector, where we aim to break down the barriers of social connection for the patients or the clients involved and the participants. So they have a connector who sits with them and talks about what the interest areas are and links them with activities that they're going to enjoy. And they will be enthused to be engaged in and re-engage their passion for life.
Well, and I love how you say, you know, you break down the barriers. So it's people are able to say, my doctor says I have to do this, rather than, oh, yeah, will I go, will I not go on a particular day? Richard, can you tell us what kinds of people benefit most from these kinds of social prescriptions? Because we do tend to think of mainly older people being lonely and disconnected in Australia, but it's not always the case, is it?
No, and that's what we found when we set up the pilot. We really had to keep the numbers short to run a program, and so we were just aiming initially for people over 65. But social isolation and loneliness is from cradle to grave. It's every age group is affected, and I think COVID particularly pushed people into social isolation, as it was really amplified the effects that has on our mental and physical and psychological health, all of those areas of well-being. And so we know from the science that humans are social beings. We need to be connected for well-being. And so we know the detriment of social isolation on our whole well-being. And so we're seeing the benefits of connecting people. So there's lots of studies around in elderly, around dementia, around maintaining social connection can stabilise chronic diseases such as cognitive impairment, and physical well-being is improved with physical groups and well-being. But the effects are amplified by that social connection. So within groups that then set up encouraging each other, that motivation, and setting up those really important social connections in a community. Our program showed what we looked at was the UCLA, the University of California, LA, of the loneliness scale. That was one measure that we used. But the outcomes were significant improvements in loneliness for those that were involved, but improved social connections and social activities. But also what was beautiful was that they were given the confidence, the improved independence and well-being, and felt more confidence in capacity to engage in community and know that there were people out there that they could, I was about to say vibe with. I'm sounding very young, but, you know.
But we know what it means, don't we? It's an indefinable thing.
Yeah, you find your tribe, find your groups, and particularly we've seen in the regional areas like Mount Alexander, a lot of people moving out of the cities and finding themselves thinking that this is a great tree change, but actually finding themselves very isolated. So, yeah, great benefits were found in giving people the skills and to break down those barriers of anxiety and reaching out and that social connection to break through that initial, take those first steps the benefits from that.
We're speaking with Dr. Richard Mays, who's a GP at Goldfields Medical Group in Castlemaine in the Goldfields region of of Victoria. One says, I think it depends who else is there. After the Melbourne lockdowns, I sent myself off to join a gardening group. But I found myself dealing with people with massive social privilege and even some bigotry, says this text. Now I just chat to random people while I'm out and about. Sounds like perhaps you already have those confidence skills that Richard was talking about. And this is life be in it all over again, says another text. Let's have more. Nerida Dye has been on the receiving end of the referrals that people like Richard, GPs like Richard, are making for people. She's the community outreach coordinator for Campaspe Library in Echuca up on the Murray River. Nerida, how does it work at your end exactly? Tell us about the nuts and bolts of how you connect a particular person with a particular activity that might benefit them.
It's like Richard said, we like to go in to, I guess, their comfort zone, their home, their place of residence, spend time with them, build a bit of rapport. And in doing that, they'll give us some sort of clues and keys as to what might have been a previous interest or a previous passion or a hobby that they've put aside for whatever reason. And then we work to identify, how we can connect them with that. So they might join the Tai Chi group, or we, go for the informal walking group, whatever their interest is. We try to locate that within our community, whether it's at the library or through the neighbourhood house, or like I said, there's many informal groups that get together for those social purposes, and we make that connection for them, support them. If they're lacking a bit of confidence at going, I mean, it's you yourself would know, even as a fit, confident person, sometimes you're invited somewhere and you doubt yourself. You go, yes, I'll go. And then it comes to the evening and you go, oh, it's a bit cold today, or I work late, or we find those excuses. So we try to build enough rapport and provide the support to get them going those first couple of times. And then usually once, you've got them through the door, and if you've made the right connections, the right group, unlike the gardening experience you were saying, they'll get that joy and that passion, and they'll continue to go without our direct support. We still keep in contact with them. We want to make sure it works, because wheels fall off sometimes, or interests change or situations change. So we maintain our contact so they know we're there, and that's what I really like about our program, is that we're still there in the background just in case.
It sounds like a fantastic job, Nerida, too. You're watching that joy spark in people when you found something that they really like doing and people that they do vibe with.
I'm a little bit biased, but I do think it's the best job. Sorry, Richard. it's really lovely.
It's really interesting.
And it's not just, about getting them out into the community, because we also recognise that for some people that simply isn't possible, whether it's health or transport or whatever reason, confidence. Some people simply cannot easily get back out in the community. So we've developed supports within their homes. And an example I give is I had a lady who was passionate about knitting, but she gave up knitting because she didn't have anyone to knit for, didn't know what was the purpose, I guess. And then I had two ladies, both living remotely in terms of out of town, on farms. And we connected them by iPads, and now they knit together and they knit for the hospital.
Oh, so, that's lovely.
Yeah, it is really lovely. And sometimes one will say, hey, I've got this pink wool and June really needs it, but I can't get it to her. And I'm like, yeah, okay, I'll pick up the pink wool and I'll drive around the paddock and, around the corner and deliver it. But I think to myself, oh, is that my job? But then, you know what? What it brings to those ladies and gives them what they're giving back to the community, it's worth that little side drive and detour to do.
So. Well, and that does sound like a big part of the job, that it's very individually tailored. I love that you've got, everything from laughter yoga to antique roadshow to Scrabble or Mahjong, small things that people can do, bigger things. And one of the interesting aspects of your particular model, Nerida, is that you get referrals not just from GPs. Where else do they come from?
Yes, so most of our referrals come from allied health professionals, just because at the time we began this program, which we're talking 6 years now, social prescribing was probably not even talked about in Australia, really. It was developing in the UK. And then we just happened to make a good partnership with allied health, and they loved what we were offering and took us up. So, and it's just been more recently when we've done a research project supported by State Library that the GPs, I guess, know we're here now, and they're like, oh, so we get the referrals from the GP. But we also take referrals from our library staff who see people coming into the library and think, oh, this person's in need of some extra supports, or they're not coming to the library as often, and families. So we try to go out to the community and we say, you know, if your mother suddenly stops going to U3A, or your neighbour suddenly stops going up to the Scrabble group, you know, we can go in and have a conversation and find out why. Now, it could be that they've decided not to play Scrabble and they want to play Mahjong, and that's their business, but it just is a bit of a welfare check as well, so that friends and family know they're not just staying in their home. And especially since COVID, for a lot of our older community, home is their safe point, and they're less, are more reluctant to be out and about. And that's, you know, we are an older community, but it's not just our older community. We see a lot less socialisation than we were seeing pre-COVID, and we need to break down those walls and get those things happening again.
So. Yes, indeed. Well, and I understand too that sometimes you have to send people back to the doctor because you feel they need some more medical intervention than social intervention, which sounds very reasonable and wise. Richard Mays, just very quickly before we hear from one of the participants in this social prescribing program, how does social prescribing sit next to medication? Because I imagine it might be a grey area sometimes that people might need other kinds of medical intervention as well as social.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I see it as part of our toolkit, our tool belt, and not replacing any other beautiful part of our treatments. It's really, I find, it enhances the effects of everything else that we're doing in terms of, yes, we've part of our management might be a referral to an allied health professional, a specialist, or on for other care. Medication will be a key part of anything we might need to treat. But yes, it's I've found over time that by engaging people in activities that bring them the joy and bring them that social connection, actually enhance everything else. For me, getting into social prescribing, I think back to a decade or so ago where I was getting frustrated in managing chronic disease because it was literally chronic. Nothing never really changed. But things shifted for me as a practitioner and for the people that I was looking after when I started asking questions about what floats your boat? What do you do if you weren't worried about your back pain? And the activities and the part of their lives and passions that they'd let go of because of their disease was a key part of them actually getting well. So I think it's a very big part of our toolkit that we could utilise. And as we say, a lot of doctors have utilised this over years, and now we have this more formal program that, as Nerida has said, is now going global over the last 5 years or so. And yeah, I think it's very much in answering your question, it's complementary to what we do as doctors.
Some lovely texts popping in. The use of activity treatments is core to occupational therapy and what we've been doing for decades. And as you heard Richard say earlier, it's something a lot of GPs have been doing in perhaps a less formal way for a very long time. Another says, I once had a wonderful GP who prescribed buying some flower bulbs and caring for them until they flowered. This is from Carolyn in Canberra. To give me both something to do and something to look forward to. She says it was a wonderful help and I remember it fondly decades later. We've been hearing from Dr. Richard Mays, who's a GP at the Goldfields Medical Group in Castlemaine in central Victoria, and Nerida Dye, who's a community outreach coordinator at the Campaspe Library in Echuca, which is up on the Victorian side of the Murray River. Let's hear now from someone who's participated in social prescribing activities. Lek was referred to North Richmond Community Health in Melbourne, where she's now been involved in quite a few programs, I understand. Lek, welcome to you.
Hello, how are you?
Good, thank you. Tell us what was happening for you when you first went to see your doctor. How was your health then?
My health not so good. I have a little bit like physical and mentally problem. And then my GP, he referred me to mail her. She linked to the community hub in the Richmond 110 in Elizabeth Street, Richmond.
And so when you went to start talking to Mel at the community hub, what did she suggest you get involved in?
she get involved, like, what do I need? We sat down and talk and what I need. And she tell me what do I need and what support they do. Yeah.
And what kinds of classes have you done since then, Lek?
Computer class. And first of all, I would like to tell you that what mail she give to me, like what support they have, learning bank for new clothing, and second, digital literacy, North Richmond community health, casework, and counseling, dietitian, occupation therapist, all of them, they've been support me very well in the past few years.
Oh, good. So she was able to put you in touch with a few different allied health practitioners to help with those aspects of your health, but also put you into classes like the Learning Bank where you could meet some friends. Have you kept up with some of those friends?
Yes, many friends I made then by back then about 2 months ago. I just finished the course about last month, computer class.
And Lek, do you think you'll do more courses and classes in the future?
Yes, at the moment I still study online at home, and I will do more computer course.
And do you think that doing all these activities has helped your health? How are you feeling these days?
I feel fantastic. I feel like I can get out of the bed and feel motivated and can live life, no more life, and active now at the moment. Yes.
Active, yeah, it's a good feeling, isn't it? Lek, thank you so much for talking with us on Life Matters today.
Thank you.
Thank you. All the best. Lek's been involved in inner Melbourne activities in North Richmond. Dr. Richard Mays, just as we finish up, social prescribing in a way puts the onus on the individual to make social connections and address their loneliness, which, as we know, is a massive issue in a lot of Western societies. But are there structural issues at play too that perhaps we should be addressing more collectively rather than on this individual level?
Well, I think part of it is that we're supporting that individual, engage the social activities, which is an important part. I think the push now from our pilot program is to expand it to have our allied health professionals, GPs and communities, libraries aware of it, like Nerida talked about, so that that's something they think of to prescribe for people, to refer people through to. So it's that increasing that community awareness and that it's available. For us at the moment, it is, you know, it always comes down to funding a program. Currently, our connector, community connector, was a volunteer position as part of the program, and finding funding for that, and what engages state or local government funding is really the numbers. And so, yeah, we're compiling the evidence and looking at the support and the meta-analysis across the globe in terms of gathering the evidence. The evidence is tough because there's different models of social prescribing, and so we can't do sort of randomised controlled trials and fantastic quality studies to prove to the people holding the cash that this is what it comes down to in terms of health dollars. So at the moment, as per any area of healthcare and health system, it's chasing the financial support as well.
Yeah, but though it is good to see that the RACGP has had a roundtable in recent years and made some recommendations saying that they think that social prescribing is a good thing. Certainly our text messages are suggesting that's the case too. Richard, Nerida, thank you both so much for your time on Life Matters today, just giving us a little glimpse into how it can work.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Great pleasure chatting with you. Dr. Richard Mays is a GP at Goldfields Medical Group in Castlemaine in Victoria, and Nerida Dye is the Community Outreach Coordinator for Campaspe Library in Echuca, just on the Victorian side of the Murray River. And we heard too from Lek too, who told us about her experience. Lovely text to be finishing up with. Chris says the Illawarra-based social enterprise Makeshift has just published a book called Creative First Aid with 50 social prescriptions for well-being. Get them on, says Chris. It's brilliant. They're brilliant. Thank you, Chris. Up next, how do semaglutide drugs like Ozempic affect fertility? A very big question to discuss on RN.
There's an epidemic of book bans in America.
The scary thing is if we keep going, there just may be very few books left.
But books are being censored all around the world.
Writing about sex, politics, religion,
you need to be very careful.
I'm Sarah Lestrange. Join me for a new 5-part series that looks at what's driving book bans worldwide. Banned Books from The Book Show, Mondays, 10 a.m. and anytime on the ABC Listen app.
First, there was Ozempic face, this idea that you look different if you're on this semaglutide drug for weight loss. And now there are apparently Ozempic babies. So women who are taking semaglutide for weight loss are reporting unexpected pregnancies, some even while they're taking the contraceptive pill as well. So what do we know for sure about how Ozempic affects fertility and, importantly, pregnancy? While it's early days, we can still get some helpful advice here. Dr. Karen Hammerberg is a Senior Research Fellow in Global and Women's Health at Monash University's School of Public Health and Preventative Medicine. Dr. Hammerberg, lovely to have you back on the program.
Thanks for having me.
Now, there have been a lot of reports, but how widespread is this phenomenon? Do we know?
I don't think we know just yet. There are more anecdotal reports, but they are coming in and they are clearly surprising women. The data is not systematically collected at this point, but I'm sure there are authorities looking at these effects that are a bit kind of unexpected, and we will get better data, but it's certainly happening.
And Karen, what do we know about semaglutide's impact on fertility? I imagine there's a lot of here's some stories about people getting pregnant. Is that a cause and effect thing? What do we know for sure?
So what do we do know for sure is that women with obesity are less likely to ovulate regularly, and sometimes they don't ovulate at all. And of course, if you don't ovulate, you can't get pregnant. But as the weight loss sets in with the use of Ozempic, which is why a lot of people use Ozempic, is to lose weight, although it was developed for type 2 diabetes, but it has this unbelievable effect on weight. So weight comes off. And as weight comes off, the hormonal imbalances that are caused by the obesity kind of get rectified, and then ovulation starts to happen. So, of course, every time you ovulate, there is a chance that conception will happen. So the more you ovulate, the more the chance of conception. So that's what the explanation is at the moment.
But then if people are on the pill, it's not just the ovulation, is it? There's something extra going on.
Yeah, that's another category of women that have reported being on the pill and the Ozempic and still getting pregnant. But I think in that context, we have to remember that even people who are not on Ozempic but take the pill occasionally get pregnant. There could be one pill that you forgot, or there could be some episode of diarrhea or whatever that means that the pill is not effective. But I think in this context, they're really looking into whether there is a connection between Ozempic itself and the absorption of the pill. And that question is not resolved just yet. And there will have to be studies done on this, because if that's the case, people who really don't want to get pregnant can't actually rely on the pill if they are on Ozempic. They really need to take additional measures for contraception.
What would be additional measures? I mean, if the pill might be affected by Ozempic, does that mean other long-acting implanting methods of contraception might also be affected?
I think it's thought that it's the absorption of the pill, because you take it orally and it goes through your digestive system. So you could think of an IUD would obviously not be affected by Ozempic or condom use, of course, and potentially also the injectable long-acting contraceptions, I would imagine, would be not affected by obesity in that way.
I should ask too, Dr. Karen Hammerberg, if diabetes affects your chances of getting pregnant. I mean, if you've said that obesity, once you get that under control, it can help your hormones settle and you start to ovulate. Does getting your diabetes under control also help?
Well, it probably does. And the important thing about diabetes is that having a well-controlled blood sugar levels when you get pregnant is so important. So for women who are taking Ozempic because they have type 2 diabetes, if they plan to get pregnant, it's really important to, because Ozempic is not recommended in pregnancy, like a lot of drugs are not recommended in pregnancy, so you need to stop Ozempic, but you need to take something else to control the blood sugar, because blood sugar levels going up and down in pregnancy is not good for the pregnancy. So it's a tricky one, but type 2 diabetes women who take Ozempic for that reason, they really need to look at what the alternatives are before they plan a pregnancy.
It was fascinating reading up on this, Karen, because it seemed to suggest that animal studies seem to suggest that you should avoid it in pregnancy, but there was apparently an observational study suggesting that it was a very low risk of fetal abnormalities. How clear are we about the risks?
I don't think we are clear just yet. And I guess on the back of these animal studies, it is really recommended by the Therapeutic Goods Administration that women who plan pregnancy, and this is the important thing about planning a pregnancy. If you plan a pregnancy, you can take steps to, you know, optimize your health and to avoid things that are known to be bad in pregnancy. So if you plan pregnancy, it's recommended that you stop Ozempic a couple of months before. And that's on the back of the animal studies, but also on the back of the fact that we don't really know for sure whether it has any links to fetal abnormalities. The study you referred to showed that there was no big increase, but it's not a set evidence just yet whether it has or hasn't got effects on the fetal development. And I think you want to be careful with any drug in pregnancy and best avoid it in most cases.
Well, yes. Do we know what risks there are on the flip side for people coming off Ozempic during their pregnancy, as is recommended, in terms of their weight or their diabetes? I guess it's going to be quite a decision, isn't it?
It is a decision, because we also know that rapid weight gain in pregnancy is very detrimental to the development of the pregnancy. So it is a very tricky kind of balance to strike. The important thing, I think, is to, again, plan pregnancy. So if you can plan it, and then you have to obviously recommend it to get off Ozempic before pregnancy, but you then have to try and find ways to manage weight and weight gain during the pregnancy so that you don't get into another lot of trouble. I mean, Ozempic might be not recommended in pregnancy, but it's also known that weight gain in pregnancy is terrible. So we need medical advice, and we need, you know, constant monitoring and support from health professionals to try and manage weight during pregnancy.
We're speaking with Dr. Karen Hammerberg, who's a Senior Research Fellow in Global and Women's Health at Monash University's School of Public Health and Preventative Medicine, about this reports that are coming out that people taking Ozempic, a semaglutide drug for weight loss or possibly also diabetes, are becoming pregnant unexpectedly. Karen, what about the risks during breastfeeding? I mean, we're still in the early days about knowing about the risks during pregnancy, but do you have any advice for people about how soon you might be able to go back on the drug after you give birth?
I don't have any data to either support or not support the breastfeeding while on Ozempic, but I do think for any drug that a woman takes, it's very important to consult with a specialist about whether it's safe in pregnancy and during breastfeeding, because some things can easily be used during breastfeeding, but other things are not recommended. And the data to date, I don't think we have enough of it, so I wouldn't be able to say whether it's a good or a bad thing. But always consult with a specialist with any drugs, I think, in pregnancy and during breastfeeding.
Well, and we've been talking mainly about women today, Karen. Do we know how semaglutide drugs affect men's fertility?
I think there is quite a possibility that it might improve sperm quality, because similarly to women, in men, obesity and also diabetes have detrimental effects on sperm quality. So if anything, the weight loss itself, and potentially not the drug itself, but the weight loss, will improve the kind of hormonal balances for men as well, and improve testosterone levels. And that tends to have a positive effect on the quality of the sperm.
This is such an interesting topic, isn't it, Karen? I know people who've suffered from PCOS, which can have polycystic ovarian syndrome, which can have as one of its effects weight gain and weight fluctuation. That must be such a hard decision for people hearing these reports. Should I go on this drug which may improve my chances of fertility, but perhaps have a risk of accidentally becoming pregnant?
It's very tricky. And the PCOS guidelines, because PCOS is a very complex metabolic condition that similarly to obesity, affects ovulation. And the guidelines say for women that are put on Ozempic when they have PCOS that they should be taking reliable contraception at the same time for the same reason that, you know, avoiding an unplanned pregnancy. But again, weight loss can help you get pregnant. So if you really want to get pregnant, you think, you know, if I can lose weight with Ozempic, it might help me get pregnant. So if you want a pregnancy, it is a fine balance to strike. But I do think that taking Ozempic for a period of time to lose enough weight to be in the healthy or healthier weight range might be advisable, but then to stop it and try to manage, you know, avoiding massive weight gain as a result. But doing it that in a supportive environment and having access to you know, resources to help you manage your weight, because obesity is very, very difficult to live with and very difficult to manage. And you can't just be told to lose weight and then expect to go home and lose weight. You really do need a lot of support.
So it sounds like, as we've been speaking today, Karen, the cautionary principle is best, but also that you might need to talk to all your health professionals, whether that's a fertility specialist or your GP or your weight specialist or your diabetes specialist, before you make these kinds of decisions.
That's a very wise thing to do, because a planned pregnancy can be, you know, so much more healthy than an unplanned pregnancy, because you have the opportunity beforehand to, let's say, take folic acid, which is so important for the, you know, avoiding neural tube defects. And you can, if you're a smoker, you can hopefully try to stop smoking and you can avoid alcohol. So there's a lot of things you can do in advance to actually make sure that the pregnancy is as healthy as possible. And that includes managing weight and also managing type 2 diabetes.
Complicated, but lovely to have your views on the matter aired on Life Matters today. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Karen Hammerberg is a Senior Research Fellow in Global and Women's Health at Monash University. And it was actually lovely to read, too, that some of those unexpected pregnancies just brought a lot of delight to the people reporting them who had perhaps been struggling with their fertility for different reasons for a long time. Well, up next, if you were a chef, you perhaps wouldn't be surprised to learn that you came from a long line of bakers, for example. But Vikings? Some intriguing family connections in a moment on Life Matters on RN.
If your brain is hungry for insights, the ABC Listen app has a feast of podcasts. Try The Minefield.
Today we're going for the problem of evil.
Injustice and evil, if they're the same thing.
You might also like Future Tense.
And there is a sense of privilege in that idea of natural, isn't there? Which can easily be manipulated.
Without a doubt.
Or Dr. Carl.
So you can feel a slight cooling, that's latent heat of vaporisation or something.
Load up a podcast and feed your mind with the ABC Listen app.
A lot of us have had the urge to climb up our family tree and see how far we get. Award-winning chef, author and host of My Kitchen Rules, Manu Fadel, was told as a child that he came from a line of Vikings. How exciting would that be as a small child? So will Manu find out he has Viking heritage, and will his love of the culinary arts be reflected through his bloodline? You and he can both find out tomorrow night as the new season of SBS's Who Do You Think You Are premieres with Manu's episode. As well as on SBS On Demand. Manu Fadel, welcome to Life Matters.
Bonjour, how are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you. What made you so keen to take part in this program? Because it looks like it can be very confronting for a lot of people.
Sure. I don't know, it's a show that I've been watching for a long time and I've always wanted to be part of it. Unfortunately, my contract with Channel 7 will stop me to do this for years, and certainly I was able to join it. I just wanted to know more because I didn't know enough, or I didn't know much, I suppose. So I was very curious to find out my bloodline, and especially on the cooking side, I suppose.
Well, yes, because sometimes we're told stories as children, aren't we? Were you suspicious of the stories that you were told, or just wanting to find out more?
Always. My dad was always full of stories, and I don't know which one is right or which one was wrong. I wanted to find out by myself.
Let's talk about the culinary side of things. What did you discover about the food line stretching back through the generations?
On my mother's side, I'm going 6 generations, so it's pretty bloody amazing. It's 175 years, you know, it's a long time. But yeah, I just realized that, you know, I finally realized that the food was in my blood, full stop. You know, sometimes you say, oh, it does it matter? But I think it did matter, the fact that it was in the family for a long time. So being brought up, I suppose, with food around the table and not especially expensive food, but food was always important. And I saw that every French family had that, but not obviously it was different for me.
It sounds like you learnt a fair bit too about the conditions that particularly bakers worked under a couple of centuries ago, so different from today.
Well, different from today, but I suppose on my generation, when I did my apprenticeship, was pretty tough, and my dad's apprenticeship was tough, and so was my granddad. So the further you go back, the harder it seems that the industry was. And now, you know, now it's pretty easy, I suppose. It's like a walk in the park. You know, you're not allowed to do too many hours and back-to-back, you know, and so on. So the industry has changed drastically in some good and some bad, I suppose.
Yes, I love the tag that was applied to bakers back in the day of white miners just coming out covered in flour, you know, breathing it in probably.
Yes indeed. What a tough gig. I mean, working at night, every night, 7 days a week, just to provide some bread on the table, which at the time, bread was the most important food, I suppose, as well. So,
the cake was also pretty important in France, wasn't it? Tell us about the link between a very famous cake and your family.
Yeah, so obviously French pastry is one of, you know, as I said, because I'm French, but I think it's recognized to be one of the best in the world. But yeah, my great grandfather was a pastry chef and had his little shop in this little village and created this cake, Delice Chalonnais, and which is still in pastry shops over there as we speak. So again, that's quite amazing.
Wow, the Delice Chalonnais, a big deal in France.
Not quite, but in the region where my great-grandfather was from, yes, it still exists here.
And have you tried to make it yourself, Manu?
No. I think it's, again, the industry has changed and the recipe has changed, and the dessert at the time were very, very sweet and full of cream and probably not good for your diet in today's world.
Oh, I like to think of a balanced diet as involving cream and sugar and butter and lots of things like that as well. We're speaking with Manu Fidel, who is on the latest series of SBS TV's Who Do You Think You Are? And discovered, I guess, some confirmations of some childhood stories, but potentially there were some surprises too. They don't tell us the ending, sadly. You'll have to watch it for yourself, but they do pepper some clues throughout. And Manu, so this was, the baking was on your mother's side. Are you close to your mother?
Very, very, very close. Mum was a single mother with two kids, me and my sister. And so we've, even though I'm on the other side of the world, we've been very close forever.
And so less close with your father. What was that process like going through this program and having to explore that side of your family?
Yeah, I mean, I was even more curious to find out about my dad's side, because firstly, I didn't know much about my dad's life. He was one of 17 brothers and sisters, and my dad left mom when I was 4 years old. So I didn't spend much time with my dad, which means I didn't spend much time with my grandparents, I mean, my aunties and uncles and cousins, I suppose. So that's where it stopped. So I wanted to know more, I suppose, and I've learned a heck of a lot.
Yes. Well, I'm wondering, I mean, we'll talk about some of the things that you learned, Manu, but do you look back now on your childhood, perhaps, or who you are today, and start to see elements of your father's family now that you know a bit more about them?
Yeah, I think the hardworking element of it, you know, and coming from nothing and building up something. And yeah, I think the working hard has always been my motto, and that's where, you know, you the success comes from. You know, you don't get success by sitting and doing nothing. So yeah, I think that's part of it.
And it's interesting too, isn't it, when you've only had access to the stories from one side of the family, you tend to build up your sense of self from that. What was it like melding the two halves together again, in a way?
It just makes a lot of sense to you, Natalie. I feel like now a complete person, no understanding where I come from on both sides of the family and what I got from both sides. And, you know, it's really interesting to find out who you are and where you're from, and, because, you know, everyone's got a big question mark over the head for a long time, and now I've got the response from that, and it's amazing.
Mm, yeah. I was talking to someone the other day about how we don't have many objects in our families to attach stories to, so we don't have that thing of, you know, sitting down and going, that knick-knack came from blah, blah, and we can trace it back down the generations. It must be amazing to be able to work out some of those things. Tell me about the medal. Sorry, go on.
I think it's amazing because, you know, now it's all going to be laptops and phones and tablets and so on. So obviously the memories would be different for the next generation. And that's why I was happy to do this myself for my parents, for myself, and also for my kids, you know, so they've got a knowledge, a bit of history.
Yeah, no, some of my favourite memories are of sitting down with my grandmother and going through the photo box and hearing the stories about each one, and no one sits down and round a tablet and does that, I have seen. But tell me about the medal, Manu, that your great-grandmother, I think, received from the French government.
Yeah, she got a medal because she had so many kids.
Oh.
Which I, every time I tell that story to people, 17 kids from one woman, it's not really something that people can understand in today's world. But yeah, she's produced a lot of kids, so she got a medal from the government, which I don't know if it's a good thing.
Pretty sure a medal alone would not have been an incentive for most people. It would have just worked out that way.
But I think that she was a tough and strong woman, I can tell you that.
Yeah, it's fascinating, isn't it? It's kind of thinking about the conditions of people's lives and imagining what it would have been like back then for them. Then there was the story of your great-grandfather on your father's side. Tell me about Eugene.
There's so much to... I mean, there's a long life on that side, which I didn't know. And yeah, the First World War was a horrible time for everyone, I suppose. But I think it was a horrible time more for the uneducated young farmers they've been thrown into that world, which was, I suppose, they just didn't understand, you know. When you live in a farm and you look after your animals and you haven't been to school to learn how to write or read, and suddenly you've been sent to on the other side of the country to be fighting with guns that you probably never... They were saying the noises of the bombing and so must have been horrific and horrible for those people because you've never heard anything like this before. So... yeah, and it just—I won't tell you more because I want people to see and watch. But it was just unfair for everyone then, I suppose.
Yes, it was the first time, I guess, it was such an industrial scale war, wasn't it?
And the places, the things that I've heard and the things that I've seen today. I mean, I can't imagine what it was then. It's even going to the museums and seeing, you know, the bits and pieces, you can't comprehend.
Yeah.
Even now I'm speaking about it and I've got my skin shivering. It's just weird.
Yes,
And that wouldn't happen today. We'd be useless if we had to... or put a backpack and take a gun to go to war.
Yeah, I know. I can't imagine anyone I know surviving in the trenches. I know those graveyards in France just have such a kind of ghostly feel about them, and I think it's really useful to sit and contemplate that for a while. And you can when you watch Manu Fidel on SBS TV tomorrow night. Who Do You Think You Are? Launches a new series with his episode. I have to ask you, Manu, about the Vikings. How much can you tell us about that?
Well, it's been incredible that we've been able to trace back to the 15th century. and find out who my family was at the time and who my family was hanging out with and who those people were from. And, yeah, apparently, surely, there's a trace of Viking in my blood, so which is pretty damn amazing because my dad used to say so, but I don't think he knew himself, but I think he is happy to know that the real truth of it. We've got some Viking blood in our veins. So I don't know. There's something cool about that.
Yeah, I imagine that would be something that a lot of people would hold on to as a family story, even if there was a tiny, tiny little skerrick of truth behind it. So how has making this program, Manu, changed your relationship with your father?
Better than ever, to be honest with you. And it's crazy to say that, you know, I think there's a mixture of us being older, more mature about things, and that TV show bringing us together. That's 75, I'm 50, and you know, it's water under the bridge. We've caught up and we didn't even talk about the past. We talked about the present and we talk about our future connection. And yeah, it's something I can take from the show, which is brilliant. So, it's fantastic. You know, let's put it this way. It's never too late to reconnect. And I'm glad I did, because that's 75 and I would be so angry if I didn't make the connection again before, you know, that passes away, I suppose, because, you know, he's closer to that than I am, I suppose.
Well, and when you talk about the thinking about the future, you have kids, Manu. What do you hope for them when it comes to continuing the family line?
The Johnson's definitely not going to be in the food industry. He likes to eat, but doesn't like to cook. barely doesn't like to do the washing up. So. and my little daughter, she loves food. She loves different cuisines, and she may have an interest, but we'll see in the near future if she does that or not.
Exactly. Sometimes we have to give them all the family stories and then step back and see what they do, don't we?
Exactly, indeed.
Manu, it's been lovely speaking with you today on Life Matters. Thank you so much, and I look forward
Thank
to the program.
Thank you very much, indeed.
Pleasure.
Cheers, darling. Thank you.
Bye. That's award-winning chef, author and TV personality, host of My Kitchen Rules, Manu Fidel. And his episode of Who Do You Think You Are launches tomorrow night, the new series on SBS, or anytime on SBS On Demand. We were talking a little bit earlier about this idea of social prescribing, where you go to your doctor and they say, sounds like you're having trouble forming social connections. Let's see if we can remove some of the barriers. Here's a referral to a particular community group that can connect you with something that you like doing. Lots of responses on our text line. Ginny puts in a word for the introverts. She says, we don't need to be made to be joiners at any age. I don't think it's compulsory, Ginny, but that's a really good point that different things are going to suit different people. I like the model that one of our guests talked about, where people knit with each other, but in their own homes because they can't travel, via tablet. So that might suit some people too. As a speech and language pathologist, says another text, I'd like to issue a social prescription to parents of young children to, one, read to your children, and two, visit your local library and participate in sessions like baby rhyme time and story time. Great for boosting language development, and libraries are also great for social connection. And yes, one of our guests was doing the social prescribing model, receiving referrals from GPs through the library because it was such a perfect hub for that. This story was very powerful. It says, I once lived in a rooming house. There was a woman upstairs who I didn't even know was there. She hid in her room to avoid the noise and because she was unwell. I discovered she used to be a grounds manager, so we got chatting and agreed that I'd deal with the manager to arrange somewhere she could plant stuff and I'd do the ground prep and she could take over. Within a few months, she was well enough to go back to some light site management just because she'd been able to do what she loved. She was still sick and couldn't do what she used to, but it took me only about 1.5 hours to help her on her way a tiny bit. So you can see how if that was happening in a more formalised way, it could be extremely useful. We've talked a lot about health today, and on our next episode, we'll continue that theme by asking if we're making the most of our pharmacists. We often head to the GP with our health queries, but with fewer GPs bulk billing and costs going up, it might pay to know just how many of our questions a pharmacist could help with. medication reviews, wound care, even sleep apnea support. The role of the pharmacist has changed a lot over time. So we'll see where it's at now on Life Matters here on RN with me, Hilary Harper. Talk to you then.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.